This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Not so much an economic fact check of the president on the program this afternoon as it is a contextualization of what he said. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 23rd of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. President Trump has given three speeches in 3 days this week, about Afghanistan on Monday, to the American Legion today, and then the campaign rally in Phoenix last night. That last one was the most freeform of the three, the most off-script, and the most economic of them all. So that is where we are going to begin. Some of what the president said and the level of economic sense it makes. First of all, this bit about his border wall and how he is going to make sure it gets built.
Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
That is, not sign a budget bill passed by both houses of Congress, shut down the government to force Congress to fund his wall. We asked economist Abigail Wozniak at Notre Dame how much economic sense that makes.
You should think of a shutdown as a very small recession. But that's basically what it's doing. And just like a recession, it's going to hit ordinary Americans harder than anyone else. These are the people who are going to depend on their paychecks. They depend on those small business loans that don't get processed. They are looking to get permits or approvals for things that they want to move forward with in their lives. Those are going to be put on hold. And ultimately, they're the taxpayers who are going to pay the costs.
Costs of the last shutdown in 2013 in lost economic output, about $23 billion. That's according to Moody's Analytics. You know, by the way, who is not a fan of a shutdown? This guy.
I don't think a government shutdown is necessary, and I don't think most people want to see a government shutdown, ourselves included.
Speaker of the House Paul Ryan there. He and his GOP colleagues are on a tax reform tour of big American manufacturers Intel today. The president did mention tax reform last night. He likes to say tax cuts, which are not the same thing. He also talked about NAFTA, negotiations over which have already started.
I don't think we can make a deal because we have been so badly taken advantage of. They have made such great deals, both of the countries, but in particular Mexico, that I don't think we can make a deal. So I think we'll end up probably terminating NAFTA at some point. Okay. Probably.
Probably. We called Ann Owen. She's a professor of economics at Hamilton College.
When you stop international trade, there are often people that we could identify as benefiting, but there are also people who you could identify as losing out from that. So it's never a very straightforward proposition to terminate trade and say we're all better off. I think sometimes it can impact people who don't even realize that they'll be impacted by it because they don't always know that the goods that they're purchasing are the combination of goods from many different countries.
Ann Owen there at Hamilton College. NAFTA negotiations resume next week in Mexico City. End of September is when all that shutdown talk is going to pick back up again. Today in corporate news, that's a little easier to keep straight economic sense-wise. There has been another shot in the pitched battle between Amazon and Walmart and Amazon and Google. There's news that Google and Walmart are going to partner up to add Walmart items to Google Express and allow voice order purchasing of Walmart stuff that would be using Google's virtual assistant. Marketplace's Adrian Hill takes a look at what the play is here.
I'm not going to say the name of my digital assistant, so I don't cause any chaos out there. But order toilet paper.
Based on your order history, I found Cottonelle Ultra Comfort Care toilet paper. 36 rolls.
Yes, I stockpile toilet paper. And yes, Amazon has made it easy to order by talking to a device. But most of us still don't shop this way. For Walmart, the partnership with Google.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that is forward-looking.
Doug Stevens is a retail futurist. He says Walmart is also making a grab at a new customer base.
this is definitely an attempt on the part of Walmart to try and jump the rails and get over to a new track where they could potentially attract a more urban, more affluent, more tech-savvy consumer.
The play here for Google is also a pushback against Amazon, just from a different angle. Krista Garcia is an analyst at eMarketer.
There was a study last year that was even a majority of people, when they want to buy a product, they go straight to Amazon. They don't even start at Google anymore.
So is this pairing reason to make Amazon leadership nervous, awake at night, sweating? Nah.
If anything, it gives Amazon some validation that their strategy is the one that everyone wants to follow.
James McQuivey is an analyst at Forrester. Amazon, he says, will be hard to best at this game, at least anytime soon. According to Slice Intelligence, Amazon's current market share is about 41% of all e-commerce in the U.S. It's a brand that people trust with all sorts of things, including their toilet paper preferences. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders didn't take kindly to the shutdown talk. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. People sometimes refer to banks in this economy with a one-size-fits-all casualness. Fact is, though, that other than both of them handling money, J.P. Morgan really doesn't have that much in common with your local community bank. And though smaller banks have long said they shouldn't be regulated the same way, looks like regulators have heard them. The Fed, the FDIC, and the Comptroller of the Currency have all now said they are going to hold off on a pending set of rules and think about some new ways to do this. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
If you are a bank worth $250 billion or less, your life is about to get a little easier. Upcoming regulations are going to be simplified. And that is great, says Chris Cole. He's vice president of the Independent Community Bankers of America.
For our community banks, these requirements were very onerous.
Roughly 2,000 community banks disappeared between 2008 and 2015. A quarter of them just plain failed. Others merged together to form bigger banks. Bigger banks are not as good at serving local communities. Cole says the prospect of overregulation played a role in all this.
We hear consistently from our members that regulation is one of the prime reasons why community banks are merging these days.
That's not true.
Robert Shapiro heads Sonicon, an economic advisory firm, and he was Undersecretary of Commerce under President Clinton. He says most regulations on community banks haven't taken effect yet.
What's really been killing community banks is lower interest rates and increasing competition.
But he still thinks relaxing regulations on community banks is a good idea.
Community banks will never pose a systemic risk.
So, he says, there's no reason for regulators to rein them in so tightly. Keith Maestrich is CEO of Amalgamated Bank, one of the banks that would see simpler regulations.
I think the merit behind finding simpler regulations for small community banks, and I want to stress small, is really important.
What he doesn't want to see are simpler regulations for medium-sized and larger, systemically important banks. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
With summertime winding down, college students are headed back to school or to campus for the very first time, and more of those students than ever are likely to need some kind of mental health services once they get there. Anxiety and depression are the most common complaints of college students seeking care. Drinking and drug abuse continue to be problems on campus, so a lot of colleges are responding by beefing up their counseling services. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Hi, everyone. Hi, how are you doing?
At the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, a few dozen incoming freshmen are getting a tour of the Counseling and Psychological Services Center. There's a large waiting area and 50 counseling rooms housed in a brick office building near campus. Meeta Kumar is Associate Director for Outreach and Prevention.
We really want to emphasize the fact that anyone can benefit from this. 20% of undergrads at some point or another come to us.
That's almost double the rate 15 years ago, says Director Bill Alexander.
We have increased our staff accordingly from 10 or 12 staff to over 30 now. We have a huge training program, and when everybody's here, it's a lot of people.
In a survey last year, the American College Health Association found that about 20% of college students have been diagnosed with depression at some point in their lives, twice the rate when the survey started in 2000. Mickey Sharma is president of the American Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors. He says in the past few years, anxiety has overtaken depression as the top mental health concern.
This generation of students have grown up in a very fast-paced society with high expectations. That, I think, is coupled with our students' coping skills and ability to be resilient is not as high as we'd like it to be.
There's also more awareness of mental health issues, so students are more likely to seek help, and colleges are taking more responsibility for treating them. Victor Schwartz is chief medical officer of the Jed Foundation, which works to prevent suicide among college students. He says schools used to refer students off campus for psychological services.
And now in many schools, the mental health services really function like psychiatric emergency rooms, walk-in clinics, counseling services, and kind of full-service mental health care systems.
That's expensive. Adding one trained counselor to the staff can cost $70,000 to $85,000.
But we also know that people who are actively depressed do have lower rates of graduation from college. So there's really an incentive for the schools to be providing good access to care and good care to their students.
Sometimes that means working harder to reach students who may not seek out help. Terry Wright is executive director of the Steve Fund, which helps colleges improve their services for students of color.
Stigma is a huge issue in the lives of students of color and what it means to seek services and admit that I need help. When in fact, I feel like as a young person of color that I'm already being judged differently.
Which brings us back to that orientation at the University of Pennsylvania with Associate Director Meeta Kumar. The students are part of a summer bridge program to help prepare low-income and first-generation college students for their first year at Penn. Many are students of color.
What do you feel might be some concerns that could prevent one from seeking counseling?
Embarrassment.
Judgment.
Failure.
Sessions like these are designed to fight that stigma. Counselors are also meeting students where they are, hosting workshops in dorms and dining halls, and trying to shift the focus away from mental illness to promoting wellness. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And I thought, you know what? That's an amazing life lesson. And I put it in the book.
Things you can learn playing video games, Minecraft. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 87 points today, 0.4%, 21,812. NASDAQ down 19, 0.3%, 62.78. The S&P 500 off 8 points, about 0.3%, 24.44. We told you earlier about Walmart and Google. Investors walked right on by. Walmart shares barely changed. Alphabet, parent company of Google, up 0.2%. Amazon down about 0.9%. Not a day to relax for Lazy Boy. Sales were up, but not enough to hit forecasts, and earnings were less than expected. Shares down 20%. New home sales numbers out today, down 9.4% last month. One consequence, people are spending money fixing up their existing homes. Lowe's missed earnings estimates today. Investors hammered shares, down 3.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I saw a tweet this morning from a guy I know who lives in New York. It said, quote, starting to think NYC subway as some sort of expletived up psychological experiment stuck between stations for an hour with inaudible announcements. This has been the summer of transportation hell for New Yorkers. Penn Station, a main rail hub, is getting an overhaul that is forcing a bunch of reroutings. And the subway is just plain a mess, and that's being kind. Because fixing all of that is going to be expensive, New York is thinking about extra tolls or fees for drivers who want to get into Manhattan or enter its most crowded parts. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks into congestion pricing.
The debate over whether New York City should charge its drivers more is less about the city's traffic choke streets than it is its subway service.
Are you a regular subway rider? Yes.
Every day.
In the packed train, a couple nearby starts to argue.
You have my game given everybody an
this is typical. This is really typical.
Did I ever tell you I wanted to be just with you alone? Nah, right? Aye. Sound crazy.
Drama, drama, drama. Michael, a college student, says he's used to it, whether it's commuting in the midst of a lover's quarrel or the service.
Always a derailment, always delays. It's really bad.
This summer has been especially bad. So bad, New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, declared a state of emergency for the subways, pledging $1 billion for improvements. It's one reason he thinks that congestion pricing is, quote, an idea whose time has come, though he hasn't released a specific plan yet. Revenues from drivers could be plowed back into the transportation system, like the subways.
The simple economic theory is supply and demand.
Steve Schlickman is a transportation consultant.
If the supply is limited, your price is going to go up. And that's what happens during congested periods.
During rush hour, demand, i.e. cars on the road, spikes. So under congestion pricing, the cost of using those roads should spike too.
What it tries to do is divert discretionary travelers to either take a different time of day, typically outside the peak, or to take another mode of transportation. So it's using market forces to make that happen.
Critics say these charges can be harder on low-income travelers. And fairness is one reason New York City's mayor, Bill de Blasio, said this week that he doesn't like the idea. Other large U.S. cities have also been resistant. Jonas Eliasson is the director of the City Transport Administration for Stockholm, Sweden, which started charging to enter its inner city in 2006. London and Singapore have similar programs.
It met a lot of political resistance at first. But then what happened almost immediately after the congestion prices were introduced was that the effects were overwhelmingly evident. We literally saw large queues disappearing from one day to the next, essentially.
He says the number of cars going into the inner city dropped roughly 20%. The public voted to make congestion pricing permanent.
Both the public opinion and also the political opinion surrounding the congestion pricing changed extremely rapidly from a very strong opinion against the charges to a fairly strong opinion in favor of the charges.
Jonas says even he was a bit resistant about Stockholm's plan at first. He used to think people didn't have much flexibility about when they traveled, but some do. He says it's also important to make sure people have good alternative options, like the subway, bus, or bikes. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you're looking for pointers on how to survive the zombie apocalypse, because, you know, could happen, I direct your attention now to the works of Max Brooks, specifically the epic World War Z. Brooks has made a specialty of looking at things differently, I guess you'd say, a skill that continues in his latest book. It's a different kind of survival adventure based on the online game Minecraft. Max, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here.
We should say right at the outset, you are a Minecraft aficionado.
Aficionado is a wonderful word. We used to just call them nerds.
Okay, pick your own, but you play the game.
Very much so, whenever I get some free time.
Why then write a book about it? Was it something that was calling you, or did Mojang, the company call you?
No, a little bit of both. When I started playing the game, it was through my son. And as I started playing it with him, I realized as a player, it's amazing. But also as a parent, every single challenge in the game on survival level essentially teaches you life. Patience, planning, you name it, Minecraft has it. And so eventually when Mojang, or as I've just learned,
Mojang,
asked if I had a take on Minecraft, I said, oh yeah, oh, I'm ready to write this book.
Well, and it plays into, broadly speaking, the theme of your writings, which is survival and getting by.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, this is the exact same theme of every single book I've ever written, which is characters thrown into adversity, which they did not ask for, but must adapt in order to survive.
There's another theme that runs through your work other than being prepared, and that is, I guess, fear, right? It wouldn't be too much actually to say sheer terror if you get to World War Z, but fear and uncertainty and anxiety.
Yeah. And, you know, my parents, who were no stranger to fear and anxiety, taught me from a very early age.
We should
age
say
to
who your parents are, Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, right?
Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. Or as I like to call them, my father, the combat veteran of World War II, who spent his formative years defusing mines and booby traps.
Yeah.
And my mother, the closet scientist, whose favorite book was The Microbe Hunters. They both taught me the best way to deal with fear is to confront it and study it, because what's so terrifying about fear is the unknown. And once the unknown becomes known, then you really can fight it and conquer it.
There's a just to make a turn here off what you said about your dad and him being a World War II veteran and having that combat experience. You too, although not a veteran, have ties and interest in military affairs.
Yeah, a little bit. My initial experience was in ROTC in college, in which my main memories are simply running track and then dry vomiting every morning. But now I'm on a think tank at West Point called the Modern War Institute, and part of my job is to study military issues embedded in non-military stories, like Monsanto, or logistics in disaster preparedness, or Venezuela.
Tell me about the Monsanto thing, because that's actually fascinating.
Well, ironically, it all started from an NPR story, probably was Marketplace, where it was the initial Supreme Court case of Monsanto turning seeds into intellectual property. The idea that for the first time in history, America is vulnerable to food blackmail. Because now that Monsanto has a legal claim to 80% of our corn and 90% of our soybeans, they have sold themselves to Bayer, which is a German company, which we have a security treaty with, which is great. But there is nothing in the bill of sale to stop Bayer from selling it to China. And there is nothing to stop China from using food the way OPEC used oil in the 1970s.
Can we talk for a minute actually about how you approach that kind of analysis? Because not everybody looks at that Monsanto thing and says 14 layers down, well, this could be a strategic threat if XYZ and, you know, double X and double Y and double Z happen. When you approach it, how do you do it?
Dyslexia. I can tell you that growing up dyslexic prevented me from the standard method of learning in our school system, which is memorization and regurgitation. I simply couldn't cram the facts into my head for a week and then vomit them out on a standardized test. I had to understand every minute detail of what I was learning. And then once it stays in my brain, I'm able to connect those facts with new facts that are coming in. So when I first heard about Monsanto, I realized, wow, this is potentially OPEC. This is the oil embargoes of my childhood of the 1970s. So that's why I'm able to connect it.
I don't want to keep implying themes to your work here, but it seems to me that there's another one that's fairly constant, and that is change, both in Minecraft the Island, certainly in World War Z, and lots of other stuff that you've done and talked about. I would appreciate your sense of change as we sit now in this political and economic environment in this country, when all of us are deeply, deeply stressed on many levels about probably a bunch of different things, depending on who you are.
Yeah, I honestly think that the last election was a referendum on change, where you had one candidate who said, listen, the world has changed and a lot of you have been left behind and you have to reinvent yourselves and it's going to be hard and it's going to take patience. Then the other candidate said, listen, I'll give you a time machine. where I'm going to take you back before the change, when you felt strong and young and powerful and relevant. And that message sold. In order for us to survive this change, which, you know, it used to happen every 20 years. Now it's happening, seems like, every 20 minutes. You wake up one morning and you need a whole new skill set. And that's what I was trying to get through in Minecraft the Island. I mean, literally, when I was writing Minecraft the Island, they changed the game. And I woke up one morning, I sat down at the game, and suddenly all the rules were different. It was a new version. That's an amazing life lesson. And I put it in the book. Sometimes the world changes, and you've just got to change with it.
Max Brooks. Most recent book is called Minecraft the Island. Max, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, a milepost of sorts for the digital economy. 10 years ago today, August the 23rd, 2007, the hashtag was invented, or more accurately, the pound sign was repurposed. A guy by the name of Chris Messina, a longtime tech guy in Silicon Valley, had the idea. Now, of course, the things are everywhere. Branding, sponsored hashtags, and worse, really. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 87 today, 0.4%, 21,812 on the blue chips. NASDAQ down 19, about 0.3%. S&P 500 off 0.8%. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.